Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Okay, we can go to Derry now, and I'm joined by a man who contains multitudes, really. He is and has been a journalist, an author, a civil rights activist, a politician, and I think a general maverick, really. Eamon McCann, how are you?
Hi, I'm grand, I'm fine. How's yourself, Brendan?
Not bad. How is the ataxia?
The ataxia is ataxia varies. It's an unwelcome condition, but the most unwelcome thing about it is that it's unpredictable, that sometimes I'm fine, and other times I simply can't walk. I can't get up out of a chair or a bed, and that can be very, well, frustrating. And I don't walk very well.
Okay, and then you don't know coming into each day how things are. And is that it? Is it just the legs really it affects, yeah?
It is just the legs, yes. At least I haven't noticed anything. Nothing else has happened to me, sort of, that I've been able to self-diagnose or whatever. It's yes, it is. It's inability to walk, really, and unsteadiness generally. It's that I have.
And I suppose the litmus test of anything is, are there things you want to do that you can't do, Eamon?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'd love to be able to. This isn't self-pitying at all. It's
at
all. I mean, I'd love to be able to go over to the shop for milk. I mean, I'd love to be able to walk unaided for 50 yards. There's a whole series of things like that, sort of, in which my mobility and coordination are affected. And that can be very as I said before, it's frustrating. Frustrating is the word I would use most.
And, I'd say you don't like about it. I presume you're dependent as well on your partner, on the family a bit, are you? I'd say you don't like that, do you?
Oh, yes, indeed. I'm dependent on lots of people, really. I mean, is that, to misquote Tennessee Williams, that line from A Streetcar Named Desire, you know, sort of, I am dependent on the kindness of friends, and I find I can be dependent on the kindness just of passers-by and of anybody. I find it's one of the things I've discovered that is about this whole condition, is that people are kind. Quite amazingly, I suppose that's banal, really, to say it. You would expect somebody with a bit of a stagger coming along, people to be kind to them. But I am constantly impressed, sort of, and I'm constantly made more appreciative of people, sort of, by the way that I'm treated. Sometimes it's embarrassing, you know. I don't need two people with chairs running towards me just because I stumbled. However, I'm grateful to people for trying.
Yeah, I don't think that's mundane at all, because it's sometimes, isn't it, we only find out that when we really see it ourselves in life, and it can be quite a profound thing to see. Are you still able to indulge? I know your main loves really are music and football. Are you still able to indulge that?
Oh, yeah. I've got a season ticket to the Brandywell. I haven't missed a match this season so far, and I love that. And the other things that I usually do, sort of, I'm capable of doing. Most of the things I would do are an awful lot of them are in my head, so that's not affected at all, I hope, I think.
Yeah, and you can read and write, like, which is, it's good to have that, isn't it? Come here, you know, as you get older, I think there's a pathway for people my age now that we're not sure about. As you get older, do you stay into rock and roll and keep up with the new music, or do you have to start getting into jazz or classical or something at some point, or how does it work?
Well, I tell you what, and I know this sounds like an evasion. So I like all music.
Yeah.
There's no type of music that I don't like. I mean, I went to the opera sort of when I was in Naples for a few days. Way back, Aida, and it was absolutely swept me away, and I thought I must go to more operas. But of course, I never had time, sort of. And I love jazz. I've been listening to jazz sort of all my life. I'm not an expert on it, but a close friend now dead, Mickey Joe O'Kane, used to be absolutely an expert on jazz and would tell me sometimes when I said, you know, it's a great old New Orleans tune. He says, that's not New Orleans, that's Kansas City. So I like that. I like Irish folk music a great deal. My favourite singer at the moment, I've lots of them, but Owen O'Canavan is a from Dublin, and it's just an amazing voice. I urge everybody to listen to Ono Canaway. I heard a young band just a couple of weeks ago, it's a fortnight ago for the first time, called Tramp, and they're from County Derry, I think, but they're all teenagers, and they've got a young singer who's just a great, she's a just wonderful singer and so full of life, it's incredible. And we've got Strength NAA sort of in Derry. I've got Melugian, he's from Lurgan originally, but he's operates from around Derry. There's absolutely wonderful music being created in the Derry area, and I imagine in other places that we know nothing about. Wonderful music being created by young people who are not being guided by anybody. Most people, in my experience of music, I mean, most young people who produce great rock and roll music are half crazy. They're just half crazy, and they're not really following a particular path, but they produce magic.
Yeah,
I mean, I won't, but I could name half a dozen songs from young Derry bands and say, you know, the person who wrote that and the people who orchestrated it and sing it, they could throw their hat into the ring with anybody in the music business from anywhere in the world. So I love all that, and I love discovering that band that I mentioned, Tramp. I mean, I'd never heard of them, much less heard them when I went to a gig sort of in Sandino's in Derry a few weeks back. Why haven't I heard of this band sort of a long time ago? And I like bands that have been around for a long time. I love the Henry girls from Donegal. The three young women, they're called McLaughlin, three sisters called McLaughlin. The Henry girls are absolutely wonderful. They've done an album of Boswell Sisters numbers. The Boswell Sisters were one of the biggest bands in the world in the 1930s. There's three women and do wonderful, intricate, interweaving harmonies on old songs and old jazz songs, Fats Waller songs. I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter, that sort of thing. Yeah. Alexander's Ragtime Band, absolutely wonderful music. And of course, the best thing about going to the things that brings everything together, the best thing about going to the Brandywell is that every match in Derry starts with the Derry City team coming onto the field to the sound of Teenage Kicks, and yeah, that's the Derry song. And there's, I mean, I'm from Derry and I know Fergal Sharkey, I know the undertones, and just to hear sort of that wonderful song, Teenage Kicks coming on to the loudspeaker in Derry, and Derry people sort of cheering and feeling patriotic about it, and feeling patriotic about singing a Derry song to welcome and to encourage a Derry team. There's something sort of which envelops me about that. I'd go to the Brandywell just to hear that.
Okay, so the short answer there is you're certainly keeping up with music in all shapes and forms. Because I was shocked to read recently that you were 80, which I imagine might have been a bit of a shock to you as well. And there is that interesting question we're grappling with now, which is that the rock and roll generation are becoming older people. And then you wonder, like, are you mellowing and becoming a nice twinkly old man? Or is there a different kind of older person now who are still rock and rollers?
Well, I would hope so. You know, it's I'm not twinkly, I don't think. Let's check with other people. It's a good question. Do you think I'm twinkly?
You were always a bit twinkly, like, with an edge. Twinkly with an edge, I would have said.
Okay. Well, look, somebody said to me, Terry O'Neill, if you remember Terry from Dublin, the old rock and roll head from Dublin, he's living in Liverpool now. And Terry said to me, phoned me on my 80th birthday, and he says, do you realise you're nearly old enough now to join the Rolling Stones? Which I thought was quite a good way of putting it. But I think that, you know, we go through all these phases. I mean, I think rock and roll is in the position that maybe jazz was a generation ago, sort of that it was crazy, self-created music, sort of in the first place and coming from particular traditions. But eventually, it comes to be that the jazz is still going, but there are classic tracks, classical tracks. We look back, I mean, to to Louis Armstrong, to Kid Ory, sort of in Closer to Home, you know, to Mary Coughlan, they're still singing, and I shouldn't say that about Mary, still singing. She'll eat me alive, of course, she's still singing. Yeah. But there are sort of older geniuses that come along who are the pioneers of the music, and we can still be listening to them sort of when they're 80 years old.
There's a canon there. When you do the sums, I was thinking you were a teenager in the 50s, when they just were inventing the teenager. Did rock and roll start percolating through to Derry then? You know, you hear about the American 45s used to come into Liverpool and Dublin, this and that. Was that the case with you?
Well, in a sense, in a particular perspective, I suppose that's an accurate description of it. One of the things I remember most about Derry in the 1950s, when I was growing up, and that's in Collins College, is that the influence of the American bass, as we called it. There was bass in, it's holdover from World War II, but it's still a bass with a few hundred American soldiers there, as indeed there were 400,000 American soldiers scattered across Europe in 1945-46, and the their forces radio station, American Forces Network, which was based in Frankfurt, huge transmitter in Frankfurt. So in the 1950s, that was blasting out Nervous Morbid, Screaming Jay Hawkins, I Put a Spell on You, I knew from an early age, Mahalia Jackson, Fats Domino. The early rock and roll was coming from there because, of course, the American forces had to service, I mean, their people. It's partly to keep them all, to keep them all happy. And a very high proportion, 40% of the American troops in Europe were black. They were African Americans, and that was reflected in the music, sort of, that was being played on AFM. You know, I was listening to AFM, and other people were listening to Radio Luxembourg, and I used to be quite snobbish about that, really, because I think you got more edgy music, sort of, on AFM. I loved it. That's one of the good things that American culture has done for me.
Yeah, yeah. And come here then, as a teenager then, just to kind of pivot slightly, at what point do you realise consciously that this is not a normal society? Or was that a given from day one? Growing up in Derry.
Oh, it was a given from day one. I think that the notion that I come from Russell Street, which is right in the heart of the Bogside, and I can't remember great anger being expressed around me about the situation that the Bogside and the Celtic working class people find themselves in, but I was very aware of it. I was very aware from a very early age, you know, that there were jobs which we couldn't aspire to, that we couldn't get houses. I mean, I remember sort of, as a child, really, sort of being in the foyer of the Guildhall in Derry with my mother having me by the hand, and we're talking to the mayor, the unionist mayor of Derry, and I remember distinctly, absolutely to this day, she said, "Please, Mr. Anderson, we've been on the list for 20 years. And we had been on the housing list, and there was really no chance of our getting a house from Russell Street at that period. Because, you know, you have to give a person a house was to give them a vote, and the unfair voting system that we had in the North meant that the Unionist Party, which was dominant, was to give a family a vote was to give a Catholic a house. I mean, to give a Catholic family, I mean, a vote. So they'd have to have a house. I mean, and that meant that they had to corral their own, so to speak, voters in particular wards in order to manipulate the outlet. I was very well aware of that. Everybody around me, everybody at school was very well aware of that.
And does that situation mean that everybody around you as well, everybody at school, all your peers at a certain point, do you all become radicalised or politicised? Everybody?
No, I don't think so, because many people didn't. Radicalised, if you mean sort of that they grew up with a hatred of the state. Now, I suppose that is the beginning of radicalism, you know, but it didn't... It didn't come across like that to me. It was just the condition we were in, you know, and every now and again, I mean, people would complain about it or try to elect a particular people, and there was always people around the area, small minority, who would say that sooner or later we were going to have to fight for it. You know, it's so everybody was aware of it. Everybody was aware of it, yes. And you know, I wasn't going around sort of at the age of 12 sort of raging about it, but I certainly was aware of it, and so was everybody else of my age.
And then in terms of the activism, am I right in thinking you were almost an accidental activist? You had actually gone off to London to be a gardener, weirdly.
Yeah, I went off to London and was a gardener. At least I was a tree pruner and transplanter, which, believe you me, is one of the best jobs in the world. I worked for the Greater London Council, and I was the only, with the 13 of us in a section called T3. We mainly transplanted trees from Forest, Epping Forest and Hainhold Forest, into the new housing estates which were being built around London under the Labour's old London County Council. So there was trees that had to be put in. And there were 13 of us in our gang. It's got T3, as I say. And I was the only non-Cockney I mean, it's not only in right. them, it's only on English Persian. They were all from Bromley and Bow, sort of in Lewisham and all that in the East End of London. Quite a number of them were, they were wild boys, you know. They were, or as they said themselves, tea leaves. They were like, you know, my friend, if, that's sort of easily caricatured. You know the guy played by David Jason? What do you call him?
Del Boy.
There was Del Boys all over the place, and guys used to disappear for 3 months into jail, and they still would get their wages because somebody would come and collect them for them. So it was terrific. I loved it. And I'll tell you what it did. It put to an end within me any sort of just visceral hatred of English people for being English. I got on very well with all those people. I can honestly say, and I know I'm in a small minority of Irish people who had lived in London in that period, I can honestly say that nobody in my work ever said a thing which was disparaging of Irish people or hostile to me because I was Irish. Not once. You know, and as I say, that wasn't the experience of everybody. It was my experience, and it affected my thinking about England and the English people.
Yeah, and then you were back at one stage, and you got drawn into a protest, kind of.
Yes, I did. I had been sort of politically active even before sort of I went to England, but you know, not every single day. Sort of, I was involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement and a few other things sort of in London. But I came home in 1968, in the spring of 1968, because my sister Bridie, who was a nurse in Winnipeg, came home for the first time. She had emigrated 5 years earlier, and she was coming home for the first time, and my mother made it very clear to me on the phone that I was expected to be there, you know, and be part of the welcoming party, as it were. So I went back, intending to stay in Derry just a few days, or at most maybe a week, and while I was there, I was walking up Roswell Street, and I met my old friend Dermy McLenahan. Dermy died a couple of weeks ago, and I miss him every day. So I met Dermy on the street, and I said, "How about you?" I go, and he says, "We're going over to pull a caravan out across the road and block the road into and through the Bogside." And that was to do with the fact that four people, John and Mary Wilson and their three children, were living in this tiny caravan, which was literally sort of in a back lane in behind houses, which was muddy. There was no paved road there. There's no electricity. And they were living there overwhelmingly because they were Catholics. So we ran a campaign, or Dermy was on the campaign. I joined in, as a result of which I was charged with, under the Road Traffic Act, actually, after a couple of demonstrations there. My first political conviction was under, I think, section whatever it was of the Road Traffic Act. But that garnered a bit of publicity. We had about 30 people when I first went over with Dermy. We did it again a fortnight later, and we had about 500 people. And at that point, we all realised we are on to something here. There's something happening here which wasn't being expressed in ordinary day-to-day politics. And that really was what plunged me into Derry politics and the sort of radical politics of the civil rights movement in Derry.
And I read an interesting piece you wrote. It was kind of hooked on the wall there. You're now entering Free Derry. But you explained the context in which you saw what you were doing, which was kind of not a local context, really. You saw this as kind of, this was a part of the general counterculture movement across the world, yeah?
Absolutely. And that phrase, "You're now entering Free Derry," and I mean, I take credit for that. It's not an original phrase, but it was I who devised it on the night in question and had it put up on the wall. And that's the most enduring thing I've ever written. "You are now entering Free Derry." Now, that came from Berkeley in California in 1956, in the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, with Lenny Glazer and other people who were active out there. And there's a student occupation of Berkeley College. It was over disagreement over the curriculum that had been taught in the college. But in the entrance to Berkeley College, there was a big sign, sort of saying, "You're now entering Free Berkeley," for the free speech movement. And I thought, well, that's cool. And then when we came to Derry, I had that put up on a gable wall. Interesting sort of serendipitous fact is that a couple of years back, when the Black Lives Matter demonstrations were on, right in the centre, sort of Portland, Oregon, there was this Capitol Hill, Cap Hill, which is where the municipal buildings are, and there's a huge sign outside it saying, "You're now entering Free Cap Hill," and it was on a board, big board, about 12 feet high, which was in the exact shape of Free Dairy Wall and the lettering, the exact lettering that was on Free Dairy Wall. So there's right. something that came from California, back over the Atlantic turn, and then back again. So I mean, I love that, and I love that connection, and it's and I mean, if you're sort of young or even youngish, sort of the idea we're running down Rossville Street with sort of stones in your hand, I mean, taking on the cops of the British Army and chanting sort of the cliched chants of the time, 2, 4, 6, 8, organise and smash the state, in the knowledge that there were other people across the Atlantic and across Europe running down streets and chanting exactly the same thing. Now, that's a heady experience. Yeah. It's something to be aware of. And the one difference between now and then, or one major difference, is that we were all aware of that. We were aware that we were part of something huge that was happening all over the world. Now, of course, that diminished over time, probably in other places too, sort of. But I remember that as one of the most exciting periods of my life, if not the most exciting.
Yeah, I can imagine. When you talk there about you and your colleagues in England and how that made you think, and you talk there about, you know, not being part of something bigger than a localised thing. I was talking to young Northern author Michael McGee a few weeks ago, and I think he was saying, roughly speaking, that the real divide in Northern Ireland is class. And I think you would probably, as an old style kind of leftist, you would probably go along with that class is the real war, but that somehow was the sectarian divide, was it some a kind of a con done on the working classes?
Yeah, I mean, class. I come from a trade union family. My father sort of was a trade unionist all his life. It's what he would have been best known for on the bog side. There's Ned McCann. He's a labour man. That was the phrase always used about him. He's a labour man. And it's difficult to remember now sometimes, but at that period, I mean, and the bog side voted about 60% nationalist, 40% labour. Not anything else. I mean, right. Labour, and there was a big thing. And in our house, I remember sort of sometimes in the evening, there'd be 8 or 9 men, always all men, sort of in the front room, sort of with the air thick with tobacco smoke, discussing. There was a dispute here, a strike there, Dairy Trades Council and the Electricians Trade Union that my father was part of. So right from the beginning in the house, I was aware of trade unionism and what it was about and the need to. My father's great heroes were Anorim Bevan, as he had founded the National Health Service in England, and Noel Brown in the South, who was Minister for Health, of course, in the early 1950s, when he undertook the programme, which in effect eradicated tuberculosis, TB, sort of in the South. So those were both Ministers for Health, both Labour, both radical leftists. So those were the people who were talked about in our house, rather than Patrick Pearce. No harm to people who began by talking about Patrick Pearce or anybody else. But that was my experience. That was my political baptism.
What are your reflections now on the state of Northern Ireland right now?
Well, you know, it's Well, you see, Northern Ireland is relatively quiet now, of course, and that's a good thing, the fact that people aren't being shot on the street. I know everybody says this, but the reason why they say it is that it's obvious and undeniable. So, I mean, that's an awful lot better than it was for the previous half century. I think that we've still got a problem. Well, obviously, we've got a problem with the sectarian division of people, that we have got two separate communities, and that our politics are still sort of largely constructed on the idea of communal solidarity of two separate communities. And the idea behind the Good Friday Agreement, for example, being to ensure that there was balance between the two communities, not to be attacked and got rid of the division, but to be had balance. And that's where this elaborate architecture sort of was erected sort of around, you know, the assembly and everything else by the Good Friday Agreement, you know. And it's you know, people say now and said at the time, look, this is the only way it could work. Well, let's see, sort of. It's early days yet, of course, to see all these things working out. But yes, I mean, I do think sort of that we still, of course, we still have the idea that we've got separate education. It's just enraging, and that's mainly the fault of the Catholic Church, incidentally. That's not the fault of the unionist bigotry or anything else. Overwhelmingly, that's the fault of the Catholic Church, that we still have Catholic and Protestant children learning their multiplication tables in different buildings. How ridiculous can you get? Yeah. You know, and it's very hard not to crack. You know, there's an awful lot of people in power in Northern Ireland who have vested interest in not stirring up sort of any further unrest or discontent. I mean, it's about the segregated education has never been a big issue there. And so that'd be sorry. This will only take a second, but that will. Offbeat thing I'll throw in here. The first Minister for Education at Stormont was Lord Londonderry. Now, Lord Londonderry, he was an eccentric sort of a guy, but Lord Londonderry said, with the new state, and with a lot of mentions of the celebrations and other ways of the new state of Northern Ireland at the time, for having a new state, we must have a single educational system. And he argued quite strongly. Of course, I mean, he was ferociously attacked sort of by nationalism, by the Catholic Church, and sort of the other side, so to speak, who were half in favour of segregated education anyway, because they didn't want sort of their children being educated beside ragamuffins from the Bogside and Craigan. So, you know, there's been an awful lot of, as I say, vested interest. Even today, you will note sort of that there isn't really sort of a mass campaign against segregated education. It's become part of the wallpaper of our lives, sort of in the north. So there's an issue which is still to be tackled. And I'm not saying that integrated education would solve all the problems of sectarianism. Of course not. They're rooted in history and in economics. But it would be a good step forward if we said that children will go to the same school or can all go to the same school on the same basis. That would be a step forward. I mean, how sad is it that we have to say that in the year 2023?
Yeah, I think a lot of people were surprised to hear that. I think these is only 8% being educated together. It's over 90% anyway in segregated education still. Mm-hmm. Listen, Eamon, I feel you're only warming up. We'll have to talk again. But do I take it, just before you go, from all of that, what you've just been saying about the church and everything, you're not creeping back towards the religion as you near the end or anything, no, as so many people do?
Look, as every day goes by, I become more firmly and more deeply rooted in my atheist beliefs.
Yeah, and do you reflect at all when you hit 80? Do you think about what might be ahead or anything, or do you just keep taking one day at a time and keep chancing your luck?
I do take it one day at a time, of course, in that every day I'd pass a sort of a day less than I have in the future. No, but I just keep going. I don't worry too much about the future. I worry sort of about my health, of course, and I worry about the fact that I don't have enough time or anything like enough time to do all the things that I want to do. But I'm not sitting around worrying. I feel grand. I mean, sort of, and I feel I've an awful lot of fuel left in my tank yet.
Okay, and what are the priorities now of things you'd like to do?
Well, my priorities are, I mean, I'm involved in the environmental movement, the grassroots network, and the Gathering. Sort of, I'm involved in, you know, a whole range of environmental matters. I'm involved in the trade union movement, and I'm involved very quickly. If you
quickly
ask me what are you most proud of? I'm most proud of the fact that I was prominently involved in the movement that got Raytheon out of Derry. Raytheon is one of the biggest arms companies in the world. It's the Patriot, the Javelin, and so on, exporting arms to the Middle East. One of their offices in Derry, and our campaign drove them out of Derry. And we got an arms company out of our town. Now, I think that was a good thing for a society that was shredded by violence sort of over previous years. That was a great thing to be involved in. I'm proud of that.
Okay, they messed with the wrong guy there. Eamon McCann, thank you very much.